time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Spain in Arms is a new military history of the Spanish Civil War, examining how the Spanish Civil War conflict developed on the battlefield through the prism of eight campaigns between 1937 and 1939, and shows how many accounts of military operations during this conflict are based on half-truths and propaganda. It's the new book by ER, otherwise known as Ted Hooton. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Ted Hipstead. Ted, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, John. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, here in Spain. We just celebrated the, if that's the right word for it, the 80th anniversary of the end of the Spanish Civil War. It was a conflict that was bloody. It was a conflict that pitted, literally, families, brothers against brothers, fathers against sons. It had huge repercussions on how Europe dealt with fascism. In fact, it was a testing ground, you could say, for the Germans and the Italians. Is that a fair comment on the background?
It's a fair background, a fair comment. Incidentally, the reverberations of the war still last. I believe there's a dispute going on over Franco's grave at the present time.
Absolutely, yeah.
But yes, it's in a way it was. It was sort of. People think that this was a war fought by proxy, by Rome. Italy, Rome, Berlin and Moscow, but it was actually, and people tend to forget this, and especially military historians, that it was a Spanish conflict, and the events were, the decisions were made by Spanish, Spanish leaders, and it was based on what they required, not what their so-called masters required. These masters were in fact more servants than masters.
And it was an incredibly complex, well, I mean, I've researched quite a bit of this, living in Spain and being liking my history. I've researched the Spanish Civil War, and it is confusing. There are so many different campaigns. Barcelona was a hotbed of anarchists, of communism, of, I mean, it is a complex, it's not just a case of Franco versus the Republicans.
Oh, no, it was extremely complex. I was once in Spain on a coach tour, and as I mentioned in my foreword, our guide was a Catalan lady whose family spoke Catalan, and whose father served in the war, and I was astonished to hear that he'd served on the nationalist side. This is a very, very complex conflict. But where the operations are concerned, it is relatively straightforward. The battles themselves can be confusing, but the campaigns themselves are fairly straightforward.
Is it fair to say that it was a sort of stop-start conflict?
Yes, it had to be. All conflicts are really stop-start. Because you use up your ammunition, you suffer casualties, and then you have to stop and rebuild your forces, and then you start again.
So where did you begin then, when you decided, and why did you think the time was right? Because we have had several books on the Spanish Civil War. Why did you think, was it the fact that we are celebrating, if that's the right word for it, or we are marking the 80th anniversary since the end?
Well, it was an opportunity, but the point is that this is, so far as I can discover, the first English language military history of the Spanish Civil War. That is astounding. What is even more astounding is that many writers have tended to ignore the mass of published Spanish material, which is incredibly valuable.
So
it's a gold mine of material, and it's largely ignored for some reason.
Is that because, then, do you think, because there was such an interest in Spain and what was happening? We know about the international brigades. We know about, for example, Hemingway at the Hotel Florida in Madrid writing from his hotel room, because you could see the front lines literally from your hotel room. Is it the fact, you know, things like Guernica, the well-known Condor Legion, all the Italians sending their troops over? Is this perhaps tainted the fact that it was a Spanish conflict?
I think it has. There's a tendency to white hat, black hat it. You know, you remember the westerns before before the Second World War, the villains tended to wear black hats, the heroes white hats. And there tends to be that approach. The side that you favour, you regard without criticism. And the sides can be criticised. To give you an example on the military side, Spanish officers seem to have been under training before the Civil War to be injected with inertia. In fact, the whole Civil War may well have been due to this, because many of the senior leaders, when the uprising took place in July 1936, especially in places like Madrid and Barcelona, they dithered. They didn't know what to do. They'd made their move, and then they didn't know what to do next, and it was as if they were expecting orders. And this was the problem, that throughout the Spanish army, on both sides, there was this tendency to lack initiative, and there was a tendency to express yourself in masses of written orders. This even happened on the nationalist side during the advance on Valencia. Corps commanders were having to tell division commanders how to move their brigades.
Was that, perhaps,
that was something that astounded me.
I mean, is that perhaps one of the things why Franco could, with the uprising, you know, Franco's uprising when he flew across the straits, you know, into Spain, the fact that he had a large sort of Moorish army, he had the Moorish legions with him?
Moorish legions, a nice term. What he actually had, the Army of Africa, was the only professional armed body, professional army under Madrid's command. And he had total control of that, and that enabled him to seize Andalusia. So, and he himself had flown to the north, to the royalist territories, the Requeti territories, around Salamanca and Burgos, he was able to use that heartland of the nationalists and then use his own professional troops to seize Andalusia, link up, and then establish a substantial state.
So is it fair to say, though, the nationalists did receive arms from Italy and Germany, and they received troops, but obviously they had to know how to use those weapons that they had?
Yes, they did. But the point about the arms deliveries to both sides, in total, you'll find that actually the Republicans received more arms, but these arms supplemented, to both sides, they supplemented the existing stock from the old Spanish army. But what really tipped the scale for the nationalists was not only that they were more effective at producing weapons from the arms factories they possessed, but they had this incredible battlefield recovery system, which combed through a battlefield, recovering every weapon and round of ammunition that they could find. And once they refurbished them, they were able to then expand their armies with captured equipment.
And how effective were the Republicans in fighting a war against a united, if you like, a unified semi-professional army, which the nationalists had? I mean, we know that the Brunetti campaign, for example, was a success.
It was. Yes and no. You should understand that both armies were mostly made up of conscripts. The professionals that Franco had were largely destroyed in the Madrid campaigns, rather like the British army at the First Battle of Ypres. And both sides then had to fight with conscripts. But the Republican army, its biggest problem was that it had very poor overall leadership. There was constant battling between the various political factions as to where they should attack. Brunetti was the place where they should have won. The plan was for essentially a pincer campaign, a bit like Stalingrad. But the southern pincer was just shot to pieces. And the northern pincer, it fell apart due to very, very poor leadership from corps to divisional level. I mean, you have Campesino, the Republican commander. He faced a defensive position at Criona, and all he was doing was doing frontal assaults. He hadn't even done a reconnaissance of it, so he wasn't aware that the positions extended further south. And as I pointed out, he was basically knocking at the front door and getting thrown out every time he tried to force his way in. And it took him the best part of a week. And that week, the fact that Lister, on the other side, failed to use his initiative to keep on going and cut the Ethramo-Majura road, that doomed the campaign. It meant that the Nationalists, by an excellent piece of staff work, were able to hold the front, bring in reinforcements, and then strike and destroy most of the Republican gains. So it was a disaster.
Many people may be trying to get their heads around the fronts. What were the fronts? Madrid was being fought over. Barcelona was a hotchpot of, Republicans, communists, anarchists, and anarchists.
Well, there were three fronts, really. The southern front, which I haven't dealt with. There was the northern front, the enclave of Bilbao, Santander, and Gijón. There was the front in front of Barcelona, Aragon, basically. And then there was the front from south of Aragon, around down to Teruel, and then curving round. So there were basically down to the Madrid front. So there were one, two, three, four fronts.
And is it safe to say that Teruel was perhaps the defining moment of the conflict?
I think it was the tipping point. It was initially a considerable success for the for the Republican forces, but the response of the Nationalists was very rapid, and it was pushed and pushed, and the forcing the Republicans to fight a battle they couldn't win, a battle of attrition. I mean, they were always short of shell. They failed to mobilise their own industries, even though their industry was much more extensive than that of the Nationalists. So they were forced into a battle of attrition, which cost them thousands of men, a great deal of equipment, weakened the whole front, and especially around Aragon. The Nationalists had always planned to hit Aragon once they'd conquered the northern enclave, and that's what they did now.
You talk
and
about
the whole front fell apart.
You talk about the northern enclave, yes. The Basques, and you cannot mention that without, obviously, thank you very much. Absolutely. I mean, it is. Guernica is, it's one of the defining moments in modern warfare. It is, if you like, one of the first attacks on a town from the air, targeting a civilian population. What were the repercussions of this? And has this, again, coloured the way that we look at the Spanish Civil War?
Well, four things I pointed out at this. One, it was bombed by the Condor Legion. Two, the Nationalists were complicit in the events. It was not a terror attack, and Guernica wasn't even supposed to be the target.
But the Guernica's got massive symbolism, though, for the Basque people.
Yeah, but the Germans didn't know that. Richthofen, the chief of staff, cousin of the Red Baron, asked people, anybody know anything about Guernica? And they said, no. Nope. But it was a railhead, it was a major rail base, and right next, just outside the town, was a major small arms factory. In fact, every Spanish officer and policeman in Spain before the Civil War had a Guernica-made pistol.
Right.
It was a legitimate target.
So it was a legitimate target. What about the Italians in the air? Because they obviously sent an awful lot of troops and threw an awful lot of sorties.
They flew a lot of sorties. There's a document in the British National Archives intercepting their communications, and you can build out a considerable picture of the number of sorties they did. It was useful for the Nationalists, but decisive, not really. They were actually more effective attacking shipping, the Italian Air Force and the Italian Navy, but that's another story. On the battlefield, they weren't all... Air power was useful, but it was never decisive. It was they had a superiority, and they could exploit it, but they were never able to, they certainly never interdicted the Republican communications in the same way that the Allies would do with the Germans from 1943 onwards. It was useful, yes, but it wasn't decisive. It wasn't strong enough to be decisive.
And talking about decisive, for the Republican side, I mean, we know all about the internationals. There's a great romantic story about the international brigades, and they, you know, I think the last volunteers died only within the last 5 years or so. The Soviets, you would have thought, would have backed their Republican allies, but was it the fact that they were so split that it was difficult to get the equipment to the right people?
I think the problem was for the Russians was that Spain, from their viewpoint, was on a very, very long supply line. I mean, for example, they had very few ships that could carry bombers, so they'd have to charter them. And these supply lines were vulnerable to Axis attack. In fact, this is what happened from 1937 onwards. The Russians provided what they could, and it was tended to be the aircraft were excellent. The tanks were the best in Spain, but they basically emptied their armories of old weapons, not obsolete, but old weapons, and with a leavening of new weapons. For example, they supplied the DP-28, what they call gramophone-like machine guns, but they also supplied loads of other weapons which they had no use for, even in their reserve formations.
At the end of the war, it's safe to say that Spain was devastated, huge amounts of people fleeing across the border to the then sanctuary of France. What are your conclusions on the Civil War, and what conclusions do you draw from your book, Spain in Arms?
Well, it's the military side. It's that it was almost like 1919. It wasn't the Blitzkrieg, which a lot of people talk about. It was sort of largely infantry-based attacks with artillery, just as there were in the First World War. But they were able to do far more manoeuvring. Incidentally, some of those Spanish refugees died in, I think it was at Oradour, the massacre up in northwest France.
Mm. Indeed. And talking about generals, I mean, Franco's generalship, I mean, obviously look at that, and I'm trying to remember the name of the general who was frightening. Eye patch, one arm.
Malin Destre.
That's the one.
Yeah, the Foreign Legion commander.
Yeah,
mad as a bagger full of frogs.
And he had his, didn't he? He really did have a death cult. But what was the standard of generalship? Was Franco a good general, or did he have subordinates who were more up to the task?
He was a competent officer, sometimes prone to flights of fancy, but he had a very good staff. His chief of staff, Vidon, and later de Villa, were excellent. De Villa was his chief of staff first, and then Vidon. And de Villa later was led the armies in the north. What he had was a very, very good team. For example, his operations officer, Colonel Antonio Barroso, a very, very capable officer, and this is what he was able to use. He also was basically living over the shop, because quite often he would live in an apartment on the floor above where the general staff was based, and he would meet his senior officers socially in the evening. So he had a much more relaxed and access to them. He could exchange views. He could be very stubborn, but he would listen to what people said, and he would sometimes reluctantly switch strategies. That was why he struck into the northern enclave. He couldn't get anywhere with the around Madrid, and he was persuaded to strike north, and it proved a war-winning move. Because he provided him with, destroyed a threat to his rear. He captured vast amounts of equipment, had more bigger recruiting base, and he had resources, financial resources, to pay for some of his weapons.
When you come to research a book like this, I mean, the Spanish Civil War, rather than just doing perhaps one of the campaigns of the Second World War or perhaps the First World War, we're 80 years since the end of the Spanish Civil War, and the the wounds are still deep in Spain.
Yes,
you drive up, in the village in which I live, which is 15 minutes from, or 20 minutes from the Costa del Sol, only 2 years, three years ago, they dug up 11 people who were shot outside the village. And Spain is littered with tales of the atrocities like that.
Yes.
I'm not even mentioning what happened in Badajoz, for example, the massacre there. How difficult was it to write about and get information about the Civil War? Because, you know, Spain had the Pact of Forgetting. Let us not forget the Pact of Forgetting. And it's still raw. Even today, we have, as you said, the moving of Franco's remains, the taking down of fascist symbols, which you can still see in buildings and through Spain.
Well, the... It was very easy. There is a mass of material which military histories of one sort or another, literally dozens upon dozens, and of very, very high quality research. In fact, there was no need for me to look through Spanish archives. Why have a dog and bark? There was masses and masses of research. The curious thing, by the way, is that while there are many books on the Republican army, there seems to be very little on the Nationalist army. Even after the Civil War ended, you'd think there'd be something about it, but no, nothing. There's something on units, the Nationalist divisions, but so far as I can discover, nothing on the Nationalist army. But there are masses of books as the official history of under Colonel José Martínez Bande. Excellent, well-researched books, possibly, obviously, from a slight viewpoint, but he never appears to have allowed himself to be to write something for purely political purposes. He looked at it purely from a military viewpoint, and there are a large number of Spanish authors who have done the same. They have done the country proud, frankly. And it astonished me at how little this treasure trove has been plundered.
I often talk when I speak to people who've written histories about what you call the eureka moment, the moment that you come across something that in a file that you haven't been expecting, and it suddenly clarifies or gives you a different perspective on what you're writing about. Did you have a eureka moment on this book?
Yes, when I was reading a thesis on the training of Spanish officers. It opened immediately, and it explains so much. Some reports in the official account of the advance on Valencia. It explained the dithering during the uprising of July 1936, and it also explained a very great deal about how operations developed, say, on Brunete. It was a very, very good thesis looking at how the Spanish army was trained, how it thought, and it was truly a eureka moment. And do you know, at the moment I've forgotten the name of the author.
I was going to say, when you write something like this, do you get do you identify, do you have a, I know it's a difficult thing because of the horrors of the war, but is there a person that you really quite admire during the Spanish Civil War?
To be honest, no. The one I respect, I mean, there were some very good officers like General Vicente Rollo, who was the chief of staff. But the one I rather respected was this Officer Barroso, almost unknown, but the operations guy, and also General De Villa, because he was the man who really crushed the Republic. Not so much, but he was acting as Franco's hands or spear, if you like, but he was the man who basically put the army, who did the campaigns, which largely crushed the Republic. It was his troops who destroyed, after Mola was killed in an air crash, his troops destroyed the Northern Enclave. Then he went, attacked in Aragon, split the Republic in two by advancing to the sea just south of the Ebro, and then he destroyed Catalonia. And not all that well known, especially outside Spain.
What do you hope that people take from the book then, Spain in Arms? Do you think they get a better understanding, and it wasn't of the actual conflict itself, rather than just saying, oh, well, the Nationalists won because they had Germany and Italy supporting them?
Yes, this is the point. What I'm trying to do is provide an insight into what happened on the battlefield. Academics and writers tend to ignore this. Then there's the people who write the chronicles of the international brigades, lion cubs led by donkeys, and this is an attempt to be cool. I mean, when I'm writing, what I try to do is make Mr. Spock of Star Trek look like a raging neurotic.
Sorry, that's I'm going to use that in a future promo for that one. Absolutely.
Be my guest.
Absolutely. The book is called Spain in Arms. It's out now by Casemate.
Yes.
If people want to find out more about you, Ted, do you do the social media thing? Is there a website?
No, I don't. There is a reference to me on Wikipedia, but it actually includes me and a cousin.
Right.
Who I believe is now dead.
Okay, fine. But we can find you. Casemate Publishing has got the actual book itself. Only begs the question, Ted, after this, what's in your sights next?
At the moment, I'm doing a two-volume book on the Desert Storm, Desert Shield, to be followed by volumes on the Israel's conflicts with the Arabs. These are all for Hellion publishers. But I would like to do a book on the naval side of the Spanish Civil War.
Happened off Mallorca, etc.
Oh, yes. Actually, I was in Mallorca visiting Porta Soler, a lovely place, by the way, and I never realised until looking through some accounts that at one time some Italian submarines were based there.
The book is... There's this thing about Spanish Civil War, that the people sort of pop up and strange units come through as well. The book is called Spain in Arms, A Military History of the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. It's out now by Casemate Publishing. It's by ER, otherwise known as Ted Hutton. Ted, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much indeed, Jazz, and all the best.